Hey, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, Sunday, October 14th, 2018.
Right. And we're a little bit at a disadvantage.
We are, more so than usual.
More so than usual, because today was the Covered Bridge Ride. It's a bicycle ride that is in Tinicum Park.
In Bucks County, PA.
And we've been doing it, you told me, for 20 years we've been doing
it. It's possible it's 20 years.
I can't even count that high. It is 55 grueling miles, meaning it's a lot of climbing. Uphill. And the problem with the Covered Bridge Ride is
the covered bridges.
The covered bridges. And the reason is because when you go through a covered bridge, that means you're at sea level. And you have to slow down because the wooden boards cause you to slow down. And guess what's after the bridge? Uphill.
Yes.
So you're in a standing start going straight uphill. But
we do it.
We do it.
We do it
God
because it's our
why.
Anniversary.
It's our anniversary.
Other people get to go to restaurants.
No. Everyone does this. But this is what some people do harder things. I'm letting you off easy. This is what
really?
We do for our anniversary.
I think we've talked about this before. Anyway, we survived. It was a little bit chilly.
Right.
It was a little bit demanding.
That's right. But if we start trailing off, you'll understand why.
Right, because we are pooped.
We're pooped.
And you know, by the way, we do it on hybrids, which are heavier bikes than the majority of the people are doing them on road
we
bikes.
We deserve all the credit in the world. There's no
so
question.
So it's really not 55 miles.
For us, it's 155 miles.
Exactly.
It takes almost 5 hours. It's a grueling test of strength and fortitude, I think is a fair description of it, but we pass it every time, as we did today. And on top of that, what made it even tougher was it's been a very busy weekend. We were out late last night.
In NYC.
To go to the Jazz Foundation Loft Party Benefit, the 27th annual Jazz Loft Party. So, number one, Jazz Foundation.
The 27th annual?
That's what it says. I'm reading the program. But we got to explain what this is. Jazz Foundation, basically, and we've talked about it before, is a foundation that raises money and disperses money to jazz musicians in distress. And apparently there's no shortage of
Including there's a musician's emergency fund.
Right.
Which provides housing assistance, medical care, financial support. And then there's also, they have performance programs, jazz in the schools, et cetera. So they kind of support the jazz community in a variety of ways. And one of their big efforts, big focus this year is on Puerto Rico. Because so many venues were destroyed.
Right.
And people's livelihoods were destroyed.
Right. It's often natural disasters. A few years ago, the focus was in New Orleans.
Yeah.
You know, Jazz Center and, of course, the floods. So there's no shortage of places to disperse the money, and it's a matter of raising money. And we had previously reported on a great night that we had at a Jazz Foundation benefit, which was at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. I'm not going to go into that, but it was pretty amazing. And this is their loft party, and we hadn't been to this before. And we're just going to describe basically what it is because, you know, for small-town folks like ourselves, it was quite a departure of, what we normally go to. It was in Manhattan, but it was in all the way west. I don't know if we call that Hudson Yards or we don't, but it was on 26th Street and 11th and
12th. In a building, and we had the address, and we could not find the building, actually.
Well, it's not about us not finding. It's about they gave the wrong information. We went to some... It was
one of those New York things. Everybody knows where it is. I don't know.
You're going to a building. It's a Saturday night. It's like it's not a performance space. It looks like some kind of, post-industrial God knows what. It's kind of shady looking. There are people kind of dressed.
It was not at all. It had.
I'm telling a dramatic story here.
It had state-of-the-art elevators.
It was a very nice elevator.
Yeah.
Which stopped at the 13th floor, I might add.
Yeah. They have a 13th floor.
And when you get to the 13th floor, the setup is. And it is a loft, and it looks industrial. Give me that. It looks industrial. And it's a big space, and there are these three rooms, a long
hallway,
three
rooms.
Well, there were
big rooms and open space, and you could wander around. There were several different stages.
Three different venues, if you will. Three different large rooms playing three different kinds of jazz, right? One was
focused on Puerto Rican
Latin jazz with Eddie Palmieri, who was there. There was another jazz, which was more blues, In each case, it was three or four artists, some of which we don't know. We're not huge jazz experts. But the one that we settled in, the so-called Vanguard Lounge, was...
No, we weren't in the
Vanguard. No, we weren't in
that
the
Vanguard. That was a VIP thing. We weren't even allowed
don't
in
tell
there.
People about we we're not VIPs.
We were in Roberta's room.
We were because of Roberta Flack.
Yes, it was a tribute to a Roberta Flack was the theme of the night.
Right, and they had several performers, three or four appearing over the night, each being a set that was supposed to be an hour, hour and a half long. But as things go in jazz, as we've been told by the Jazz Foundation, you don't go by the script. Things happen. People show up. It goes off schedule. And well, that's what happened here. But
we
it was
wandered
great.
In fairly early.
Right.
Because we were trying to have an early night because we knew we had to ride hundreds of miles
hundreds
on
of
the
miles.
Bikes
hundreds of miles.
The next day.
Right.
So we wandered into Roberta's room.
Right.
And Binky Griptight.
Binky Griptight. Exactly. That's who it was.
Of the Dap Kings?
No, he was previously with the Dap Kings. Now he has his own band. It's called, I don't know. Let's see. What is it called?
You should have done your research.
Binky Griptight Orchestra. The Binky
Griptight. Anyway, he was great.
He was great.
And there were some chairs. Right. We actually managed to snag chairs.
And there's food around, and there's drink food. Around. And there's drink. People were dressed very well, and people dressed less well. And it was a huge crowd of people. And when we say we got chairs... I mean, we're as close to the performers, not exactly as I am to Tamsin here, but I don't know, what are we, 10, 15 feet from the performers? I mean, it's not like we're
More
sitting
less,
in
yeah.
an auditorium. We're right there. So we enjoyed Binky Griptight. And then
And that was followed by...
That was followed by... Sort
the
of
big a, performance.
Well, it was a tribute to Roberta Flack. So it was several people who were doing Roberta Flack-type numbers, and they were great. Right.
Yeah, they had some of her former backup singers.
Right, and they had
performing.
Some...
Valerie Simpson performed.
Right, from Ashford and Simpson, and she was fantastic. She's a great friend of Roberta Flack.
And then at a certain point, Macy Gray.
Macy Gray wanders in, and Macy Gray, who I'd never seen, we'd all heard of Macy Gray, was something. I mean,
she was something. She was actually very compelling.
Yeah, she was great.
We really enjoyed her performance. We know nothing about her music.
Right.
And she was pretty great.
Right. And she was arguably impaired. But that's okay. Maybe that's her deal. I don't know. She's a fantastic performer. And she's a fantastic musician.
A very creative, interesting person. You know how old she is?
No, I don't.
51.
Really?
Yeah.
I would have guessed 20 years younger than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of amazing. So then, and people are doing Roberta Flack, and she's just, they're just vamping, they're extemporizing. She comes up with another performer, they're clearly doing a song that she doesn't know. And she's just jumping in when she can, and then she does her own stuff. And I was telling you before, the song that she did, which is a song I'm very interested in is called Compared to What? Mm-hmm. It's her own performance, it's a very political song, and that became her major performance. It was... fantastic. And then it was time to bring on Roberta Flack. And again, this is a very intimate setting. There are a lot of people behind us, but we were like right there. And Roberta Flack, just quickly, most people know Roberta Flack, but not everybody. And I understand the time has passed. And Roberta is now 81 years old, so she wasn't performing.
But she was big during the 70s,
right.
So she's part of the soundtrack of our lives.
Right. So the songs are that they list here, for the heck of it, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, Where Is the Love, which was a duet with Donny Hathaway, who was a classmate of hers at Howard, it turns out. Killing Me Softly with his song, Feel Like Making Love, et cetera, et cetera. And,
I played that Donny Hathaway, Roberta Flack album just about, every day, maybe three times a day as a freshman in college.
And you introduced me to that, and it is a great album. And it has one song on it, I'll just tell you, For All We Know. The recording of For All We Know, in which I think just Donny Hathaway sings and Roberta Flack's playing piano, is one of the most amazing recordings I've ever heard. And anyway, so she's a great artist. She came on. She's somewhat compromised health-wise. It was a tribute to her, but it was a very emotional moment. And anyway, it was
a fun night.
I mean, they had on the program a quote from the Huffington Post and talking about the loft party. The most ecstatic music experience I've had since Woodstock. I mean, is this, you know, this and the other performance, they might be the most ecstatic music experience I've had since Woodstock, yeah. but that doesn't mean too very much.
I think one of the great things about it is the musicians.
Yeah.
We don't know who they are because we're not in the know.
Right.
But I think they're all great.
And they're with other musicians.
Probably other people know who they
right.
are.
And there are people like, well, Steve Jordan is well known. He put a lot of it together. He's a drummer and he's done, he travels with John Mayer and he works with other people.
Well, I don't want to put you on yes. the spot, but it was just great. And
yeah.
the lady who runs it was terrific. And she actually, at a certain point, some of the seats were reserved
yes.
for big donors.
Right, not us.
Okay, so we were sitting next to some reserved seats. And at a certain point, she recruits me to guard those seats.
Which is impossible.
Out of nowhere. She just turns to me and she says, you know, these are for our biggest donors. Don't let anyone sit there.
Like we can
and
do
I'm
that.
Like, you know...
So the next person came and Hampton said, are you a big donor? They said yes. And Hampton said, by all means.
Have a seat.
Have a seat. So anyway, that was an only in New York moment. And just when you say to yourself, how can these people do event after event? We actually also went to a play on Thursday night in a nonstop week. And we saw Apologia, which is a roundabout play starring Stockard Channing.
Right, written by Alexei K. Campbell in 2009. And this was just revived.
Well, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. This was revived with Stockard Channing starring in London about a year ago.
Really?
And you have the reviews. It's got
Let me tell you what, there was a little
mixed
bit
reviews.
Of more excitement in our camp than a lot of others because Stockard Channing is playing an art historian. And of course, Tamsin identifies with that. And not only an art historian, but really a celebrity art historian, as I understand the play.
Well, she's a political activist
but,
makes a living, who has become a rock star in the art historian world.
Which is insane, actually.
Which is insane.
Yeah. So you're losing credibility right there. And it's like people say, well, did you turn your back on this for the glamour and glitter of art history? And you're going, what? What are they talking about? So there are a lot of moments in this play about what are you talking about? And the principal, and as Tamsin says, Stockard Channing, who's always very good, and she was very good in this, and it is frightening to think what this play would have been without Stockard Channing.
Yes,
it would have been awful.
True.
And
that's
it's not
true.
Awful.
Yeah.
And it's not awful. But she's playing a political activist who has now reached a certain age, and she's visited by her children, and she's being forced to sort of think about, you know, how her peripatetic lifestyle might have affected them growing up, having written a memoir. They felt they weren't sufficiently mothered. I don't want to
How
get
could
it.
You be an art historian and be a good mother
it
at
is,
the same time?
Well, you've battled that yourself.
But so the funny thing is that part of the plot revolves around the memoir she has written, which
right.
is really, as she points out many times, a memoir of her work.
Right.
Okay. Her work life.
Yeah.
But in the course of the book, she does not mention her children.
Which is,
at
think,
all. Her children are more than a little offended.
And
not any part of
I'm
your life?
I'm just saying right now, when we write our memoir, the kids are going to be in there a little bit. Not a lot, but they'll be mentioned. The one speech I liked, and we started to talk about this, is a speech about Giotto. She puts herself out as a big expert and big lover of Giotto, and I, having the benefit of watching this play with an art historian, get to ask at intermission, what's the story of Giotto? And Tam says, look, everybody loves Giotto. You're not going out on a limb with Giotto.
But it makes her seem a little more sophisticated because, you know, it's not Michelangelo. Giotto is a household name amongst art historians.
In certain households.
But, yeah, right. But, you know, it makes her a little more exotic.
Well, I will say that I mentioned this, though. Harry Zerlin, who we mentioned before, and he's into art history. And Harry just laughed when I said Giotto. He said, well, they're not taking a chance. Everybody loves Giotto. And he said, I do have one Giotto story. It might be a little racy for Tamsin. I said, what, are you kidding me? Racy for Tamsin? He says, well, Giotto, of course, painted... somebody actually ended up... there's a famous question and answer with Giotto, famous exchange with someone speaking to Giotto and says... he asked him about his children who weren't very attractive for some reason. And what this person says is, you paint the most beautiful cherubs and angels and figures of all sorts, just beautiful. And yet, you know, your children You know, your children don't look anything like that. They're like, you know, not particularly attractive, if you can imagine someone saying this, the Giotto. But Giotto wasn't put off by this. He said, well, there's a reason for that. When I'm doing the paintings, that's in the light of day. When I'm creating the children, that's in the darkness of night.
I like that. You know, they say that Giotto was a great wit, and there's no question he was a genius. Get me started.
All right, I'm not getting you started. So in any event, just the line, rather than us go on and on, even though we already have, there happens to be an article. This was in London First, and here's one line from a review, which we, I think, agree captures this. He says, some things are best left in the past. And Apologia, Campbell's ambivalent examination of baby boomer morality and second wave feminism is one of them. So there you go.
But it hasn't really opened yet.
No.
So we don't have any reviews. That's from a review about the London production.
Yeah.
But so I think we'll see what the general public thinks.
Know, I think it's a pretty easy call.
You know what? The fun of it was Stocker Channing's sort of zingers and her sort of snobbish put downs of mere mortals of her family.
Yeah, that was,
you know, and their girlfriends and their significant others. I mean, that only gets you so far. And there's a big fuss about her cardboard character set up in Barnes and Noble,
right? Because
next to the pile of her
books. She's an art historian rock star. I would put it this way:
she is somewhat of a cardboard
roundabout
character.
It's roundabout. It's by subscription that we saw it. If you have a subscription to Roundabout, go. If you don't have a subscription to Roundabout, don't worry about it. Just pass.
That's you might enjoy it.
I wouldn't go out and buy a ticket.
It's not expensive. It's not like, you know.
Okay.
Going
all
to
right.
Hamilton.
Well, let's talk about things that are expensive. I'm going to come back to Hamilton. I have a Hamilton thought, believe it or not. But first, we got to talk about baseball. No, we're not talking about the playoffs and the World Series because we're not current. We don't get out there to the public quickly for that.
Can I just say one more thing about Apologia?
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, this has been a star-studded week for us.
Yeah.
Because we were just feet away from all these music greats.
Right.
And when we were at Apologia, Woody Harrelson was in the audience.
He was, and you spotted him.
And I spotted him by my little self.
It's unbelievable.
I usually don't recognize celebrities.
And New York being New York, no one bothered him.
And I was happy for him. He was alone, and he seemed engaged. He didn't have some big entourage.
No. People just, he pretty much had his eyes downward looking at the program. He was not looking to engage.
Yeah,
fine. So, good for him. And he gave a standing ovation to Stocker Channing, who must be a very close friend. So
No. I gave her a standing ovation.
I gave her a standing ovation.
I think she was very good.
She was very good.
Aside.
Yes, but we're close friends. So baseball. A book came out that is kind of interesting. It's called Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game. And here's the way this works. As everyone knows, baseball's become more statistical, sabermetric, if you will. And the person who writes this book, a fellow named Rob Nyer, knows this very well. And what he explains is, and this I didn't understand, that in order to capture all the various statistics that you hear about in snippets when you watch a baseball game and read an article about baseball, if you do, is that every major league venue, every stadium right now has a lot of cameras. They're all over the place. It's no accident. It's not like you're getting isolated statistics. Each game is potentially analyzed in many, many different ways because they're measuring the ball speed as it leaves the bat, the ball speed as it leaves the pitcher's hand, the angle that it leaves the bat, the quickness of the various fielders, how much ground they're covering, what the base runners are reaching in terms of miles per hour when they run.
Moment. So they have every single
It's like 13 or 14 cameras.
Dozen angles or something?
Play doesn't capture it. Plays, moments between plays. I mean, you know, a pitch on the outside corner, is that a play? No, but they've got that analyzed 8 ways to Sunday.
Wow.
So what this Rob Nyer does, and this is your cup of tea or it's not, and for many people, not. But what he does is he writes a book analyzing a single game, taking advantage of all the information that's gathered in connection with that game. So he's doing a moment by moment or as he chooses.
Is anybody buying this book?
It just started. It just was released.
You know, I frankly would rather have a needle in my eye.
Please.
That sounds awful.
Yes, we're selling here.
That sounds like a real snorer.
Okay. It gets a good review. But in any event, here's
From
what he says.
Who? His mother?
He says what's interesting. What's interesting is this. He says, look, and he's obviously into sabermetrics, which is what we're talking about on the one hand. But on the other hand, he has a bigger picture. And he says, all these statistics allow folks to analyze the game in a very different way than it does historically, play the game differently than it was historically, even rehabilitate injuries or prehabilitate injuries, prevent injuries, if you will, differently than it was historically. So the statistical approach has changed the game fundamentally. The problem is that all the changes wrought as a result of statistics have nothing to do with making the game more interesting to the fans. Nothing. The stats have nothing to do with it. In other words, no one undertook any of this analysis with fan interest in mind. So when people say, but the game's not that interesting, it's no surprise. Because that wasn't the objective of all this analysis. The game.
So
has
when
moved.
They say that less people are going, less people are watching, because it's for a reason.
All the money that's been invested and all the changes done have been for, you know, and objectives that have nothing to do with fan interest. And he says the only way you save the game is you say, well, that's very interesting as far as it goes. But we have to make a similar effort to make the game interesting to the fans. And this is not going to do that, as demonstrated by your observation about your lack of interest in the book.
Right. But I gotta say, the thing that you wouldn't do is ask the fans what they want, because we know that's always wrong.
No, but you have to
figure
it out.
Need somebody
to figure it out. Like you have to
needs to figure out what is interesting, compelling, entertaining.
You have to go in the basement and come up with the iPhone and say to people, here's something you never thought of in a million years, but you might be interested. That's what you got to do.
Yeah. Or yeah. Maybe they should ask Lin-Manuel Miranda. He seems to figure out.
I'm coming back to him. Be patient.
I'm patient. Okay, I just have a teeny tidbit. There was a page in the Wall Street Journal magazine this weekend, and they have a page on, they call Neighborhood Watch, and they show you some exotic place that you ought to go, and where to eat and where to shop and so on. And this week it was, I think it's pronounced DePape, and that is a south of Amsterdam city center, formerly working class district, has been made over with boho charm. And actually, that's where we accidentally stayed when we were in Amsterdam, was in that neighborhood. And it's famous for a large street market that they call the Albert Kuip. And we stayed at the Sir Albert, right on the edge there. And that market was great, wasn't it?
That's where they had the herring on the paper.
The herring on the pieces of paper and the little pancake things and, you know, a million kind of stalls that you'd have at any flea market.
Yeah, but you walk by, they say, you know, they give you $2 worth of herring on a piece of paper. How can you miss with that?
It was a really terrific area. We enjoyed walking around it. We went to some terrific restaurants in that area. So it was fun to see a place that we had been being embraced and advertised like that.
So they're right. It is interesting. So here's something that it kind of struck me because it reminded me of something. What did it remind me of? Years ago, I was working with a lawyer in Kentucky who was a very accomplished lawyer, one of the leading lawyers in Kentucky. But the economics of practice in Kentucky are different than those in New York, and he was highly aware of that. So we were talking about finances at one point. And he said to me, and I won't do his Kentucky accent, although he had one. He said, you know, I don't get swept away by all that financial stuff that you folks in New York worry about. I have a simple plan, and this may be the Southern way, but this is what I did. As a young man, I had planted a raft of black walnut trees. And the way that works, and other people do this kind of thing too in the South, is that black walnut trees take 20 years or so to come to fruition, or maybe more. And that's my retirement plan, in large part. Certainly,
not to come to fruition, to come to maturity.
Come to maturity, that's the better word. And
because they fruish right away. We have a lot of black walnuts in our yard.
Yeah.
And black walnuts, are kind of annoying to maintain. Okay. Maybe if you can, I think squirrels like them. Sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. But the point is, it's not so much about black walnuts as it turns out. Just the idea, this is his retirement plan.
It's beautiful wood.
Beautiful wood. And he said, and this would be something he'd benefit from when it came time to selling the black walnuts when he retired, and also to leave money for his children and his grandchildren, because that was his retirement plan.
So he was raising black walnuts to be sold at a certain point
right.
to cash in on.
Right. And so I remember thinking, gee, you know, it just shows you, you know, how narrow you can be. We worry about the stock market here, bond market, you know, whatever. And people go worry about going up and down. They have such a simple and arguably effective solution down south. So I see an article this week in the Wall Street Journal. And it says, thousands of Southerners planted trees for retirement. It didn't work. And what happened? In this case, it's pine trees, but I suspect it's similar for black walnut, although it's more valuable. A lot of Southerners took the same approach my friend in Kentucky did. And 20, 30, 40 years ago, they planted a lot of trees. And they figured that they would benefit from the cutting of these trees as they were older. Well, because they all planted all these trees, when it came time to cut the trees...
Too many?
There's a glut of trees. And the price of trees plummet. And I'm not talking about, you know, it turns out that there is 1,500 trees instead of 1,100. You know, this is a real Wall Street Journal article with thousands and graphs and charts and hundreds of thousands of trees and everything. And it is a huge market swing. And there are in the articles about Southerners who say, I was counting this for retirement. I feel that it's crazy to sell for the prices that I see now, but I don't have much choice. This is my retirement. I need the money now. And they're stuck. So what does this tell us? What does this tell me? It tells me that there's no avoiding the market.
So when people say they don't play the market, they want to do things the way their grandfather did it.
Right. They're wrong.
They are playing the market.
Everything's
they're
a market.
They're playing the tree market.
They're playing the tree market, but everything's a market. So you can't say, I'm not participating in the market. I'm doing something more fundamental. I'm doing something that has more to it it's not subject to the vicissitudes of marketplace. No. Everything's subject to the vicissitudes of a marketplace. There's no safe place. You have to figure out a way that looks forward in terms of how market's going to affect anything you possibly do. There's no avoiding it. And these Southerners are finding out in a big way.
Well, that's too bad, because I do love trees.
Yeah.
So it seems like a nice thing to do.
It is. Well, they're cheap now.
Right. So I have, there's a fun article in the business section of the New York Times today about a business called Rent the Runway. And this is a business where for $159, okay, a month, you can rent up to 4 pieces of clothing or accessories and keep them as long as you want, right? And then you send them back and you can rent others. Right. And if you really like them, you can even buy. And this is, these are designer clothes, okay? So very fancy schmancy.
Right.
And it serves the market of professionals, young female professionals who want to look fabulous, but don't want to, you know, can't buy designer clothing.
Right.
So people love it. Mm-hmm. It is.
Oh, it's a big success?
It is huge.
Is that right?
Okay. So they talked to Jen Hyman, the co-founder and CEO.
Yeah.
Okay, she's 38.
Wow.
All right. And they have a headquarters in Secaucus.
Oh, good.
All right. In Secaucus, I mean, nationwide, they have about 1,200 employees. 770 are in Secaucus. They have, so you get the clothing sent to you, right? And then you wear it and you send it back and it is cleaned. In Secaucus, they have what is perhaps the largest dry cleaning establishment in the world.
That doesn't surprise me.
It's 250,000 square feet.
Wow.
Okay. And they clean everything. And even if people say they didn't wear it and they just set it back,
they
smell it and they figure out if it's clean or not. So this is interesting, not just from the point of view of young women using this. And it's mostly, you know, fairly young women, and it gives them an opportunity to wear really high style clothes. Sometimes that's a disadvantage. Okay, one woman became such an object of attention at her workstation, at her workplace. You know, people were saying, "Oh, you know, what designer is this?" They were just focused on her clothing so much that she stopped using it.
These are not evening clothes. These are business clothes.
Right. It started out as evening clothes, as a way for people to, rather than buy an evening gown to wear once and never again, to rent it and send it back.
Right.
But there turned out to be a tremendous market for, you know, attractive, stylish, you know, high-end business clothing women.
Right.
So, you know, for some people, it's a huge help, and other people thought, you know, found it was too much. If you do this, imagine the money you save, because even if you're not buying the fancy designer clothing that they rent, you are spending a fair amount of money on clothing each month to keep up to date in somewhere like New York market, right? Although they, you know, they have it all over the country. Not only are you saving on the clothing, you're saving on dry cleaning bills.
Oh, that's true. I didn't think about that.
Which one woman they quote, you know, used to spend $100 a month on dry cleaning, no more. She just sends them back. One of the other interesting things is they end up with a lot of data. Mm-hmm. A lot of data about who wears what they like, what works, what doesn't work, how the sizes are. People post how they look in them. So that's interesting, not just to rent the runway and how they develop their, clothing supply, whatever. But also, it's very interesting to the designers that they're working with.
Yeah.
And the designers, you know, get all kinds of data about what people are wearing and liking that is very useful to them. How long the clothing, how well the clothing survives all this dry cleaning, etc. Now, the designers are not worried about people renting as opposed to buying, okay? Because these are not the people who would ever buy their clothing, okay?
Yeah.
Someone who's paying $159 a month to rent these outfits is not going to spend, you know, $1,500 to $5,000 to buy it. Now, they're sold at a great discount if you buy it from Rent the Runway after it's been worn.
Because you're buying a used dress.
Right. But then, you know, they're not going to.
Yeah,
if you're a young lawyer, you know, in New York, you're not going to spend those kinds of thousands of dollars.
But
on
let
outfits.
Me ask you this, and I have no insight into this, and you might not either. I don't know. But so what it comes down to is, if you're taking advantage of this, you're spending about $2,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, what do people normally spend absent this?
Well, the one of the people they talked to. Spent trying to economize, found herself spending about $500 a month.
Wow.
On clothing.
What?
Daniel, I know, you haven't spent $500 a year on clothing.
Well, yeah.
Believe me, that's a surprise to no one. Okay?
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, it's also easier because this stuff is fantabulous.
Okay.
So rather than running around, they do talk about
a young woman. They know your style.
They know your size. But, I mean, you're always trying to create that high-end look, right? So, but you're running around to the inexpensive stores, mm-hmm. you know, going through tons of stuff, trying to get something that approximates that. And, of course, it's not as beautifully made not as up-to-date.
It saves you time, right? I mean...
Right, because it comes to you.
Comes to you.
Still have to flip through on your phone the inventory
and
pick things
that,
out.
Yeah.
And there's always the chance that this is going to be great. I'm wild about it. I'm going to wear it for this.
Yeah.
And it comes and doesn't quite fit.
Yeah.
And you don't wear it.
Yeah.
So you need the, you know, option B. But anyway, it's kind of an interesting, fun business to read about. I'm really impressed by someone almost our kids' age putting this together.
That's something.
So
I'll have competitors before you know it. They probably have them now. So I was impressed by a book about Frederick Douglass, who I have to confess I didn't know very much about, and I'm not going to go into detail here because it's too much detail. I mean, but it's very impressive. What it tells a story of Frederick.
What's the book?
The book is called Frederick Douglass by David Blight, and it begins by saying, in an 1895 eulogy, The Chicago Tribune summarized his stature by declaring, quote, that no man, black or white, has been better known for nearly half a century in this country. He's a black civil rights leader in the second half of the 19th century. And what this says is that he was the most well-known person in the country.
Now, well, he was a great orator.
He was.
And writer. And he had been actually born a slave.
No, right. He was. Well, yeah, the story is unbelievable. The story is he's born a slave, and the family of his masters, if you will, or the mistress, teaches him how to read and write and gets him interested in classical texts, whatever. He's fascinated by it. He loves it.
She starts to teach him. She's reading him the Bible, and he's fascinated by the language.
Right.
And he wants to learn to read and write. She starts it, and her husband says, no, no, no.
Right. That's true.
And then what I thought was interesting is he actually goes out with various, you know, biscuits and snacks from the house, given to him, of course, and actually convinces white boys.
Schoolboys.
To give him to a book. Teach him to read and write. And they introduce him to all kinds
They introduce him in particular to a book, a reader called The Columbian Orator. And he goes from there and he just takes off with it. And he becomes this extremely learned man, as you put it, a great orator, and a great speaker, a great leader. And
the most photographed man of the 19th century,
which is startling. And the point of the book, I know. Okay, we're giving one source that says he's the most important person, but they say that David Blight confirms in his monumental and multi-themed biography that the assessment of the Chicago Tribune about Douglas being that important was entirely accurate. Anyway, it talks about his various, what political movements he became identified with, his impact, his various speeches, the people he knew, the movements that he helped begin, his personal life.
It contrasts his personal and public persona.
Right.
Which is interesting because the personal life seemed rather flawed.
Right.
It sounds like a very interesting book.
Well, what I
book.
Found myself thinking when I was reading this book was I was thinking of Alexander Hamilton. And I'm saying, because it's a very similar story. I'm saying to myself, if Lin-Manuel Miranda is really looking for another project, this is the project. This is the story. And maybe it's too on the nose, but it is a very compelling story. It's a rags-to-riches story. He's a fascinating guy. Great speeches. I mean, it really calls out for theater, don't you think?
Possibly, yeah.
Well, as for the book itself...
Are you listening, Lynn?
Are you listening, Lynn? I mean, there was... the article ends just saying it's just a great book, a magnificent book, and it's a magnificent story. So in any event, that's the book, Frederick Douglass by David Blight. And even though it's quite long, 888 pages, the journal's head over heels about it, so it might be worth looking into.
Okay, so from the sublime to somewhat of the ridiculous.
Yes.
You have some thoughts about cats and their intelligence?
No. See, now with that intro, what can I do? There's an article about dogs, and this is the kind of thing you see on television. It was covered on television. The dogs, there was some study, dogs are not that smart. That's big news. And why do they say that? They say that because all the things that dogs
I don't think
do,
you're going to make any friends with that statement.
Dogs, they're okay. They make a point that dogs have a lot of good qualities. They're just not terribly intelligent. But all the things that dogs do, horses can do, other animals can do. It's no big deal.
Apparently,
but, you know,
octopi are pretty intelligent.
Yeah, it's possible. But But they're very careful to say, they're not putting down dogs. They said, having said that, they're asked to compare cats. And they say, well, look, I can't say how intelligent cats are. They have great instincts. I don't know if that's intelligence, but I will say, according to the person who did the study, that the most intelligent people that this person knows have cats. And there are some great nuclear physicists who have like 15 cats. So what that tells you, I don't know. But there was something about cats, if you will, big cats.
It's trying to imply that intelligent species hang out together.
Yes, that's what it was implying, but no one was willing to push that point. There was an article about this tigress in India, and you may have heard of this. This
Oh, this killer tiger is a girl?
Yeah, tigress, yes. Killed 13 people. And it is a serious problem in India. Serious problem with tigers generally, because there is a large tiger population in these forest lands that are really adjoining what you call suburban residences and others, and they've pressed up against. So whereas in the U.S. you hear about a bear coming out once in a while, certainly deer. In India, it's tigers.
They know what tiger it is.
They know what tiger it is.
And they're not able to catch it?
They can't catch it. They have a lot of problems. People preserve tigers so that going after a tiger is difficult. They had to get a court order at this point to shoot the tiger.
To be permitted.
Right? Otherwise, they're trying to use a tranquilizer gun, and it's apparently very, very difficult to track down and shoot a tiger with a tranquilizer gun. But even so, they can't track this tiger down. And here's the new approach, and it's based on cologne. Calvin Klein obsession. It turns out that cats, including tigers, love Calvin Klein obsession. Because it happens to be made from the scent glands of a civet, which is a small rodent.
That musky,
yes,
and perfumey smell is from that animal.
Right, the civet. And it turns out that cats go crazy. So they are the new approach now is they're going to the jungle, dabbing various locations with Calvin Klein obsession. And they have some level of confidence that that's going to bring this tiger out and they'll be able to subdue the tiger, which is weird.
That's quite a strategy.
Yeah, it is quite a bit of a strategy. And I don't know if that's good or bad publicity.
But I think it also
Calvin
proves
Klein.
That cats are smarter than people.
Because the tiger is avoiding
all these people are trying to capture this tiger.
Well, as a matter of fact, what they're saying is that the cat's gotten smarter because since the cat's been, first of all, number one, the cat's figured out that people are easier to track than a lot of other animals. And that's why the tiger's
attacked. Not a surprise.
Well, apparently there's no memo that's gone around all the tigers, but this one's figured it out. And number two is the various escapes by the tiger. And they have had some close calls. They said it's only making the tiger smarter and more able to avoid them. So they're increasingly concerned, if you will. The tiger's going to attack again. Okay. So they're very pressed in terms of trying to catch
the
tiger.
So obviously cats are smarter than people and females are smarter.
I don't know where you're getting this, but I've said what I've had to say on the subject. All right. So we're almost finished. I wanted to comment on there was one very interesting article about movies. A Star is Born, which we may or may not see. You could talk me into it. It's not first on my list, but in any event, what I think people realize, but maybe not to this degree, people realize The Star is Born is a remake. What they may not realize is it's the fourth filming of this story. This is the fourth Star is Born, not the second. And it is extremely similar to the first one in 1937. In other words, basically you have a man who is an established star in his entertainment field, and he meets a woman who is on the rise potentially, and her star is ascending and his is descending. That's the story of every single one of these Star is Born movies, and they keep remaking it. And the question is, has it changed? And it has in one very interesting way. The first Star is Born in 1937 was made with Janet Gaynor and Frederick March. And what it was at that time was a story as much as anything about a woman going into the workplace, a small town girl. And the question is she going to stay in her hometown and have babies and that sort of thing? Or is she going to follow her dream to go out and try to become a star? And interestingly, in 1937, there's a grandmother figure who says, go, you know, this girl should be allowed to leave. And you say, wow, it's kind of women's liberation 80 years ago. And then she turns to her and says, quote, for every dream of yours that you make come true, you'll pay the price in heartbreak. And that's what the story is about, that you can go and try to find your star as a young woman, but it's not going to come without some tremendous cost. It's an interesting message. That is sort of the same movie when it's made some years later with Judy Garland and James Mason, and Judy Garland is considered the best female protagonist by a person who writes the article for The Times, a woman named Aisha Harris. But basically, she just suffers tremendously as she watches her mate, her male friend, basically stumble. She says, "I hate him for failing, and I hate me too," because she can't deal with it. But then it changes. The next The Star is Born is the one with Barbara Streisand with Kris Kristofferson, which is described as the worst of the four. No surprise, they have chemistry together.
Yeah.
And now it's a different thing. Now there's a competition between the two of them. And this is considered consistent, at least in the writer's view, with the notion that the woman taking her own career seriously and standing up for herself. And now when the guy starts faltering, there's fights between the two of them. There's a lot of resentment between the two of them, one dragging the other down, and it becomes a real battle between the two of them, even though there's clearly some feelings between them, in a way that never existed before.
You said in the early one, it wasn't a battle between them.
No.
She was conflicted, she was upset with his struggles, but it was not about...
Well, that's the second one. The first one is just the story of a young girl becoming a star. The second one, Judy Garland, is conflicted with his battles, but there's no battle between them.
Okay.
Okay, and the battle we're talking about is alcoholism. And the third movie, it's different because it all reflects the culture of the time. And now it is a fight between them about how they should be handling it and someone letting the other down, right? Again, it's alcoholism. And the fourth one, it's an open fight between the two of them about how it goes, which doesn't mean they don't love each other, perhaps, but that's really what it becomes about. And I guess it just reflects the time. But it's interesting to see how the movie, in some ways, is so similar to the one made in 1937.
But the emphasis is
The emphasis different. Is so different. And it's funny. At the end of that movie in 1937, and the male character is named Norman Main, after his demise, and that's what happens. He ends up committing suicide. What happens is Janet Gaynor's character just comes out to a microphone and ends the movie by introducing herself as, "Hi, I'm Mrs. Norman Main." Still identifying with her husband.
Well, maybe we should watch that movie and see what it's about.
Yes, that's possible.
Because that advice from the grandmother is pretty conflicted, isn't it?
It is conflicted, and maybe that reflected the kind of advice you got in 1937 when you left the small town. Even those who stood up for you said, "Yeah, I'll stand up for you, but you ought to know it's not necessarily going to work out." All right, so we end with this. There is an article in Times about a man who's 107 years old who's still cutting hair. He's been a barber since he was 12 years old. He's been cutting hair for almost 100 years.
In Connecticut?
He's in New Windsor, Connecticut. He's in a barber shop that you can walk into anytime.
I think we should say his name.
Anthony Mancinelli. Anthony Mancinelli, the world's oldest barber. In 1922, his haircuts cost 25 cents. Now Mr. Mancinelli charges $19. He's in a big haircutting place. He's just one of the guys who's by one of these chairs. He sweeps up his own cuttings. He comes into work every workday.
He drives. Goes home.
He drives at the age of 107. He lives by himself, and he's keeps to himself, and he's very content cutting hair. He has customers many generations, and he just goes on and on. They ask him, "How do you do it?" He looks pretty trim. They say he has no trouble standing all day. He says, "I eat skinny spaghetti, so I stay thin," which is an interesting approach. He's not into physical fitness or anything like it. He's just into cutting hair. He's a pretty simple guy. It's amazing. It doesn't make any sense. And so I'm thinking about that. And then I see an article in the Times written by a guy who is about 80 or so, a fellow named Robert Goldfarb. And he describes himself as a gym rat. And even, you know, notwithstanding he's older, he works out quite a bit.
He's an 80-year-old gym rat?
Yes.
Wow.
And he's been training his body to meet the demands of whatever. And he says that, you know, he's benefited from that. In a sense, he's put off the effects of old age to some degree, even though he sees
physical deterioration.
Yeah, he sees some. He's not that he doesn't see any. But, you know, he's now starting to ask himself whether the emphasis that he's put on that kind of working out, that kind of training, hasn't been entirely right. And he's thinking about his friends who are dealing with old age well and the ones who aren't dealing with old age well. And he says, you know something? Maybe I need a different kind of training. Maybe the kind of training I have is one to have a more accepting approach to things, more accepting personality. He says, my healthiest friends carry themselves as victims. Oh, some of my healthiest friends, gym rats, carry themselves as victims abused by time. They see life as a parade of disappointments. But other friends, many whose aching knees and hips are the least of their physical problems, find comfort in their ability to accept old age as just another stage of life. And so he says to himself, could I employ the discipline to accept with dignity the inevitable decline awaiting me?
So what it comes down to is
having...
Don't sweat the small stuff.
Right.
It's all small stuff.
Yes, well, that's true. The challenge is to find the contentment within me, hoping that contentment will guide me as I make my way along the path yet to be traveled, which takes us back to this fellow, who's Anthony Mancinelli, who seems to have found something. In his very simple existence, he finds contentment in what he does. He doesn't step out of his lane. And the way that article ends is he says, you know, the guys in the shop wanted, this is his boss, says the guys in the shop wanted to take him to a girly joint for his birthday, Mr. Murphy recalled. But Anthony said, no way. What are you trying to do? Kill me? Salesman right. Knows his limitations.
All right. So we've done the best we could with limited
energy. Oh, I think we did fine.
Okay. All right. So that's all from, this is Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhoff.
We'll see you next week.